It's the Burt Cohen Show. September 17th is Constitution Week. What does that mean? What's it all about? And how, more importantly, is the Constitution being taught today? And what does it matter? Our guest today to talk about this is Bill Bigelow, curriculum editor of Rethinking Schools magazine and author or co-editor of several Rethinking Schools books, People's History for the Classroom, The Line Between Us, Teaching About the Border and Mexican Immigration, Rethinking Columbus, Rethinking Globalization, Teaching for Justice in an Unjust World, and Rethinking Our Classrooms. Bigelow lives in Portland, Oregon, and has taught high school social studies since 1978, and he is with the Zinn Education Project. Bill Bigelow, thanks very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show today.
My pleasure.
Well, it wasn't very much noticed, but apparently, September 14th was Constitution Day. Why is that? What is that?
Well, it's an opportunity, I think, to carry forth what happens in most textbooks in this country, which, of course, are controlled by giant corporations, which is a major celebration of the Constitution. And that instead of actually looking critically at it, particularly from a race and class standpoint, it's just seen as something to kind of admire. And I opened the article that I did for the Zinn Education Project with a quote that is used in the Pearson Prentice Hall textbook, United States History, from Daniel Webster. And if I can just read that, I think it exemplifies
sure.
pretty much the stance of the major textbooks and curricula. We may be tossed upon an ocean where we can see no land, not perhaps the sun and stars, but there is a chart and a compass for us to study, to consult, and to obey. The chart is the Constitution. And then the textbook goes on to say that this is quoted many times at celebrations of the Constitution, and Ronald Reagan was one of those who used this quote. And so I think that it's this kind of on bended knee approach to this this founding document, rather than really looking critically at it and asking who benefited and who didn't.
There's a lot to learn about the Constitution. As a patriotic American, and I do feel rather patriotic, I grew up in the 50s when America was clearly at least seen as the good guy, I frankly long felt kind of a reverence for the Constitution. There are some great principles there, I think, that I wish our government still lived by. Is there anything wrong with that reverence and wishing that we get back to a lot of the principles of the Constitution, forgetting for the moment the rather large left-out factor of class differences and the fact that there was slavery at the time? But isn't there still a lot that should be revered in there?
Well, I think it's wrong when we try to pass our reverence along to our students. I think that our task as teachers is to engage students in thinking critically and to asking questions. And and if at the end of the day, after the questions and after the critical thinking and after the role plays, they conclude that things are admirable, that that there are pieces or even an entire document that they want to celebrate, then that's fine. But I don't think it's our role as educators to begin from the premise that we're going to end with a point where students think one thing or another about a document or an individual, Columbus, for example, or any particular piece of history.
And if you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today is teacher Bill Bigelow talking about Constitution Day, Constitution Week, and how it's being taught in our schools. And I'm curious, I had never really thought about corporate textbooks, the corporations behind the textbooks. I wonder if you could explain that and perhaps give an example.
Right. You know, we just think about textbooks as being textbooks, and they're adopted by a district or they're adopted by a state. But in fact, the textbooks are produced by giant corporations, and there's been increasing concentration over the years, so that Pearson Prentice Hall is probably the leader, and there's Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and McGraw-Hill. And all these corporations that are producing these textbooks, they have a particular stake in students seeing the world in particular ways and not seeing the world in other ways. You can imagine that these corporations are not keen to have students consistently asking critical questions about wealth and power and inequality, and so that there are many, many silences throughout the corporate textbooks. And that's really what the Zen Education Project, the outfit that I am co-director of, that we were set up to help teachers teach outside the textbook, to find both materials and teaching resources, and also a different kind of pedagogy, one that is not just read this and answer the question.
Right. Well, I find it interesting that in your article it mentions that you have conducted classes in which the students themselves act out to create their own constitution. Now, why is that a good idea, and what do the kids learn in the process?
Well, I think that they can learn a lot of things as they take on the different individuals. In this instance, in my constitution role play, the one that I wrote, I have a richer, let's say, a richer constitutional convention than was the actual one. The actual constitutional convention, of course, was just rich white men.
Yes.
And so that, say, what gets called in all the textbooks a compromise, say the three-fifths compromise,
right,
which involved how would enslaved African Americans be counted for the purposes of representation. Once students have actually enacted the role play, the Constitutional Convention, from the standpoint of enslaved individuals, they take that word compromise that gets thrown around so easily, and they can say, wait a second, this is not a compromise. You're just arguing over how you're best going to keep us enslaved. So this may be a deal between you elites, but it has nothing to do with us. And so I think that role play and having students take on the role of poor farmers and workers and enslaved people, as well as the merchants and the plantation owners who were at the actual Constitutional Convention, really allows us to see more clearly and more critically some of what was in the Constitution that we think of as benign or neutral, but in fact took sides.
Well, it certainly was. And you know, most Americans have at least heard of Shay's Rebellion and possibly the Whiskey Rebellion, which was not about whiskey, it was about taxes on whiskey. From my understanding of those armed revolts, at issue was who the government should serve. What interests? There were the creditors who financed the War of Independence. On the other hand, there were the debtors, the farmers and war veterans, who wanted their government to serve them. Was that contentious issue ever fully resolved? And was our Constitution a compromise between those two sides, the creditors and the debtors? And why is that important today?
It was resolved. It was resolved in the favor of the creditors, and at the expense of the debtors. And of course, Shay's Rebellion came in the summer of 1786, and the Constitutional Convention was the very next year. And in large part, because of these uprisings, and because there were the poor, in many cases, people who had fought as revolutionaries, they'd been in the war, and now they were finding themselves in poverty. They were finding themselves not able to pay their taxes or their debts, and so they were having their land taken away. They were being thrown in prison, And so Shays Rebellion, and we call it Shays Rebellion, but of course there were these uprisings that were going all over, particularly in Massachusetts, and shutting down the courts and not allowing people and freeing people from jail. And so, and these were considered wicked schemes by James Madison and by the people who ended up meeting to settle on a constitution that, of course, would prevent this from happening in the future.
Now, how do most textbooks now deal with Shays Rebellion and this whole debate between creditors and debtors? I don't remember learning much about it when I was in elementary through high school.
Well, you know, in one of the textbooks I looked at recently, Shays Rebellion, I wish I could find that. Yeah, it caused panic and dismay throughout the nation. And so basically, it's the textbook lining up with the wealthy who met to agree on the Constitution that this was a wicked thing. And any time you have this kind of violence and this kind of rebellion, it must signal that something is terribly wrong. And of course, it did signal that something that is terribly wrong. But the textbooks take the side of the people who want to, quote, maintain order.
Maintain order, yes. Law and order, where have we heard that before? Where do these rebellious actions, of which there were quite a few, do they relate to reality today in the 21st century?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. And I think, Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, she has an expression that journalists and journalism should go where the silences are. And I think that that's the same thing for educators as well and for the curriculum. And one of the big silences in the curriculum is the impact of social movements and of rebellions and of people in motion, and that that there's just a great silence or at best marginalization of social movements throughout U.S. history. And so students are not given the opportunity to understand that really everything good and decent and democratic that we may appreciate today originated in people's demands and people organizing and people demonstrating. And so it leaves an impression that somehow we need to wait for the benevolence of people from on high, and that good things will kind of fall from the sky, but fall from people with power. And so they're not offered the opportunity to think of themselves as potential activists. And I think that that's a key silence throughout the corporate curriculum.
Wow, and I always thought that the word citizen means you're participating in self-government. I mean, you know, there's that strain that's been there as well. And if you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, our guest now is Bill Bigelow. We're talking about teaching of the Constitution on this celebration of Constitution Week. I've long thought that the old method of teaching history through great men, you know, the great white men, are the makers of history and that we should surrender our power to them. I thought that that had long been out of favor. Do mainstream curricula, the textbooks, examine the segment of society that these great white men came from? And isn't there a lot more to America and being a citizen than trusting the great white men to do it for us? It seems like that tension has been going on for quite some time.
Yeah, it has. And I think that there is, in general, a kind of a narrowing sense of what it means to be a citizen. And so, you know, so much of dissent gets left out of the official curriculum. Let me just give you an example. You know, I have an activity on the U.S. war with Mexico. And this was really the first anti-war movement in U.S. history, where there are where there's widespread dissent and opposition to this war, and yet it's never talked about in any of the textbooks. And so, students are not let in on the fact that part of what it means or could mean to be a citizen is that you have a right to dissent and to be active and to play a role in society in ways that are other than just kind of voting and kind of doing your job well and so forth. And so I think that that again is that we need to open up that curriculum, and we need to look particularly at the role of social movements. Because if we're to get out of the predicaments that we're in today, we're going to need a lot of social movement.
Yes, we are. Dissent is perhaps more important than ever right now, and we've seen dissent actually work. So many people think they're powerless. They've been led to believe, they've been taught, I suppose, to feel a sense of powerlessness and to feel like the decisions are being made elsewhere. But we, the people, stopped Larry Summers from being the head of the Federal Reserve. And we, the people, it seems, were able to stop the crazy bombing of Syria that our, some think he's a liberal, president was about to do. And that is part of America, who we are as America. But I do wonder, and you must have been asked this before, is it really fair to apply 21st century standards to the 18th century formation of the Constitution? I mean, ideas such as economic justice and institutionalized racism, they weren't, I don't think, well, I suppose maybe they were. Well, what about this question? Is it fair to apply today's standards to looking at the formation of the Constitution?
Well, you know, my hunch is that there are always people around who have more critical perspectives than we perhaps learn, you know, 200 or 300 years later. For example, I mean, look at people say the same thing, particularly about Columbus. Well, you know, that was just that he was a man of his time, and yes, it's true that he enslaved people and that he treated the Taino people poorly, but you know that was just what people did. But in fact, what gets silenced in the curriculum is that there were other quote men of their times who were denouncing Columbus at the time, who were saying that Columbus and the people who came after, they couldn't go to heaven, they couldn't continue treating people like this. This was not Christian, and so that there was always opposition. And there was always critique, and sometimes we just don't hear about it later on, so we get to call them men of their time. But in fact, there was a critique at the time as well.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yes, and one of my favorite books, The March of Folly by Barbara Tuchman, talks about how when governments do really dumb things that they know are going to be terrible, and there are clear alternatives available at the time, and yet they go ahead and do it anyway, just a plug for her book.
I think that that's a sensibility. That's such a great point. I think that that's a sensibility that we also want to impart to students, and it needs a different kind of pedagogy. So in the textbooks, it's like they're these dead facts sort of laying on the page. This happened, and this happened,
right,
and this happened, and this happened. And it seems like there's a certain kind of inevitability. But one of the things that when we start introducing role play, in putting, for example, students in the position of being abolitionists, and would you choose this, would you choose that, and you can see that, well, no, history is a series of choice points, and that there are alternatives at any given point, and it really makes a difference what your analysis is, what you do, as to what the outcome is going to be. And that's just such an important sensibility to impart to our students today, that you matter, that you're not a spectator to history, you're a participant.
Right. History is not a spectator sport. Now, at the time of the Constitution, as is obviously recognized, it was great white men of significant wealth who made it, period. All Protestant men, I believe. What about the issue of slavery? Was it something that just wasn't looked at all by the framers of the Constitution? Or was there an option to take a look at it? Were there voices bringing up the issue of enslaving people at the time?
Well, I think it was understood by the men who were at the Constitutional Convention that actually challenging slavery was off the table. You know, there's this fellow, Pierce Butler from South Carolina, that he said, the security the southern states want is that their Negroes may not be taken from them. And he said that at the Constitutional Convention. And that sort of puts it right out there that, look, bottom line, if you want a country, if you want this, if you want a federal government, then taking slaves from us, ending slavery, not that Northerners were particularly inclined to do that, but that's off the table. And so it may be that people had private objections to slavery or had problems with its morality, but they certainly, if they wanted a country, they were not going to challenge slavery.
But there were individuals, people at the time, who were a little bit concerned about the morality of slavery. It wasn't like nobody was talking about it, but these rich white men kind of agreed, we can't bring it up for now.
Well, and of course they did more than that. They also approved a fugitive slave clause that held that even if people escaped into states where slavery was not legal, that people would be required to return
the property,
slave people to their supposed masters.
Right.
They never used the word slave or slavery in the Constitution. They were more circumspect, and they talked about people held to labor and so forth.
And returning people's properties. So as we look to the future, I mean, education is about, creating participatory citizenship in the future, or I suppose it could be creating satisfied, quiet people who just follow along and do what their leaders tell them. Bill Bigelow, in what ways does it benefit the future to have kids today think critically about the Constitution?
Well, I think it's not just about the Constitution. It's the kind of habits of mind that we're trying to develop. And so it's always asking who benefits and were there alternatives and could there have been a different route forward. And so that these kind of critical habits of the mind are the ones that we want to nurture in students so that, so that today when they look at, say, the climate crisis, they're asking those same kinds of questions. They're asking, does it have to be this way? Who benefits from seeing fossil fuels as being hands off?
And coal.
Who benefits from a society which puts profit above human need? And so those are the kinds of seeds that we're trying to plant in the curriculum from the very beginning.
And on the next half hour, we'll be talking about some of those principles. Who should the government work for? Because we're going to be talking about the second anniversary of the Occupy Wall Street movement, which I think has a lot of roots in American history, perhaps going back to Shays' Rebellion. Should the government be in service to the creditors or to the debtors, the 1% or the 99%? So it goes on. Fascinating stuff, Bill Bigelow. How can people find out, if they're interested in educating about the Constitution and about our history and about participating in, creating the future, what website can you point listeners to?
Right. Well, I encourage people to look at the website of the Zinn Education Project for more critical teaching materials. They're all free, and we have role plays and imaginative writing activities and a lot of materials that look at aspects of U.S. history that are not included in the traditional textbooks. And that's zinedproject.org. And then Rethinking Schools, the magazine that I work with, has been, for over 25 years, has been featuring teachers who are writing about ways in which they enlist their students in more critical, more playful, more participatory, and imaginative teaching. And so we actually tell stories about a different way of approaching education. And that's just rethinkingschools.org. And so those would be two sources I would recommend.
And I got to ask one more thing. I wonder how, working with kids, how optimistic you may be. I would think that kids really like, they don't want to see the dead facts on the page, that they want to be able to participate. They want to challenge and question this. I think it's part of human nature. So judging on what you've seen of the young generation, how optimistic are you or are you not for the future?
Well, I'm always optimistic when I get back in the classroom with kids. Now, I'm retired. I taught for almost 30 years here,
right.
But I try and get back into schools as often as I can. And it's sort of for that reason, Bert, that it is, if you want a dose of hope, then you get with people who are able to kind of grasp this material in new ways. And so students are hungering for a curriculum that is more meaningful, that is more, as I say, more playful, that is actually about things that matter. And that's part of the corporate curriculum that is problematic, is it's just not about things that matter. And so we need to both have a different kind of content in our curriculum, but we also have to approach it pedagogically in different kinds of ways as well.
Well, thank you so much, Bill Bigelow, for being with us today and for your dedication to teaching and education. I tremendously value it. I think most people do. I wish the government would recognize it a little bit more. Thank you so much for being with us, Bill Bigelow. All right, and we'll be right back talking about the anniversary of the Occupy Wall Street movement. Stay with us.
Young love teaches pets, cheeks flushed, apple red.
Teacher, Teacher, The Rock Pile from their greatest hit album. They only had one. Good stuff. You're listening to The Bert Cohen Show. We were talking in the first half hour about teaching history. We're going to shift into making history. A couple of years ago, it was all over the news, Occupy Wall Street. You don't see the Wall Street Occupy Wall Street demonstrations on the streets anymore. What does it mean? We're looking back at the two-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, and I'm very pleased to have back with us once again on the Bert Cohen Show, Richard Esko. Richard, thanks for being with us again.
It's always a pleasure, Bert. Thanks for having me.
The pleasure is mine. Esko is a former executive with experience in healthcare, benefits and risk management, finance and information technology. He's senior fellow with the Campaign for America's Future. Check them out. Great organization. And hosts The Breakdown, which is broadcast on We Act Radio in Washington, D.C. His reflections on blogging and spiritual principles were included in Best Buddhist Writing of 2008. He's also an occasional working musician and songwriter who appeared regularly at venues such as CBGB's Place in History, the Washington Folk Festival, and motorcycle shows throughout the American South from 1970 through 2000. What a great background. Well, September 17th, and he writes some great, great articles. September 17th marked the second anniversary of the Occupy movement. And our guest writes, the Occupy movement wasn't the foundation for change. It was the reflection of a deeper desire for it. It was the effect, not the cause, and it won't disappear. But Richard, it was so unfocused, and its physical manifestation, the Occupy street protests, are gone from sight. I wonder if you could talk about what you wrote and what you mean by that.
By what I mean by the fact that it's gone from sight?
No, that it was a reflection of a deeper desire for it. It was the effect and not the cause, and that won't disappear.
Well, I absolutely, I mean, I think the reason why it was so successful so quickly, and if you think back to 2 years ago, it really was quite extraordinary how it exploded in the public consciousness in a period of about 2 weeks when it initially began happening. The only news coverage, for example, was mocking and derogatory and silly ideas, these people camping out and playing the drums and so on. And within 2 weeks, it was a major movement. It was changing the president's rhetoric and leaders in Congress, and even some Republicans were saying, you know, they have some good points. Bank CEOs were saying, we understand their frustration. It was the initial polling on it was extremely positive in terms of the public response. And the reason for that is because any successful movement, no matter how long it lasts or doesn't last, any movement that catches on like that is tapping into something that's already there in the psyche of the society. And in this case, what Occupy did so well was, first of all, it gave a language and name to the frustration that people were feeling. The rhetoric or the image of the 99% and the 1%, for one thing, happened to be economically extremely accurate. There is a bifurcation between the 1% and the 99%, and even between the 0.1%, 0.01%, the rest of the country.
Good point.
So they crystallized the frustration, what people were seeing all around them and hadn't been able to name. And secondly, people recognized in Occupy something very true, and something that was giving a voice to their own frustration, which was that for decades, as the middle class had been slipping behind, the ability to climb out of poverty or to go from lower middle class to upper middle class had been eroding, and then we had a terrible financial crisis, and immediately the government and the world rescued the wealthy and powerful, right, and left everyone else behind. Right. People had been feeling all this. Nobody had been clearly articulating it on a national level. So, you know, as people are always, is it just me or is this something going on here? Occupy was able to say to people, no, it's not just you. It's real. There is a 1% and a 99%. And the rest, there are other people who feel that way. And immediately, instantly, people responded to that because the economic reality was already there and the frustration was already there.
Yes, it certainly was. And 99 and 1, it was just so clear. It seems people really got it. And yeah, I find it fascinating that it seems in that 2 years, the 1%, the 0.01%, whatever, the very, very top, are doing even better than they did before. And generally, the 99% oftentimes are doing worse than they were. There is virtually no middle class anymore. It's just, it's appalling how different it was. So given that 2 years has gone by and, you know, some could say things have gotten worse since then, might that just be a function of history doesn't move that quickly, that there's, you know, there was that action of Occupy and the reaction, and it just takes a little while? Or why do you think things may have gotten worse? There's so much better for the top 0.1% and not much better for everybody else.
Well, I'll tell you how much better it's gotten for the 1%. They saw in 2012, they saw their income increase by a third, by 32% in 1 year. It went up 32%. The rest of the country saw their income increase by 1%. And that was the first income increase at all in the 4 years since the crisis. so we've seen that not only did the crisis, which was caused by the 1.01%, caused by Wall Street, not only was that taken as an opportunity to insert some sanity and some controls into our economic system, but it was actually taken as an opportunity to reinforce and strengthen the wealth disparity of the 1%. So we now have a situation, as you know, where 400 families, 400 households have more wealth than the bottom 150 million Americans. So, and it has gotten worse since the year 2000. The median household, the average household in this country, has seen a loss of $7,490 per year in their adjusted income. That's in a period of 13 years, and that's just the average. That's including the 1%. So for people who aren't in the 1%, the figure's even worse. So it's gotten worse for since 2000. Now, there was something of a boom in the 1990s, but even if you go to the 70s, the middle class, excuse me, has been treading water and has even fallen behind a little bit. Poverty numbers rose substantially after the Wall Street-caused crisis in 2008, and they stayed high. They didn't continue to increase, but they stayed high in 2012, according to the newest census report. So we do see a situation where poverty increased, the middle class is falling behind, and these are average numbers. Certain things are now completely out of the reach of the middle class or lower-income yes. Americans to all extent and purposes, like a higher education, which is what gets you out of, you know, gets you into the next tier of economic opportunity and, in many cases, personal fulfillment. That's been taken away, or been made much more difficult. So as a result, social inequality, wealth inequality in this country, as economists measure it, has also gotten much worse over the last 40 years. So we really do see a country that's being re-engineered on behalf of the wealthy and the extremely wealthy,
yes.
And that's what Occupy was speaking to.
And the issue is certainly still there, and I'm not sure exactly when the phenomenon known as the Tea Party started happening, but it seemed to be a little bit, just a, you know, a couple of years perhaps before that. You may know better than I. But it does seem, I mean, and that they are also kind of a populist anger. They're more rageful, I think, than the Occupy people, who were angry but not so much full of rage and talked about solutions as opposed to the Tea Party, which doesn't. But what I find fascinating, and I'm hoping you can speak to this, is that the Republicans have been remarkably successful at co-opting and channeling the energy of the Tea Party. And it seems like, frankly, the Tea Party is running the show of the entire Republican Party. Not so for the Democrats. Even though the public really understands the 99 versus 1% framing, the Democrats are just, for the most part, not doing that. I mean, we have exceptions like Elizabeth Warren and a few others, but this, I think, could help Democrats win if they spoke to the 99 versus 1% framing. What's your sense of why this is as it is?
I think there are two issues here. I think one is the Tea Party. First of all, it's amazing what a few hundred million will buy you.
And yeah, true.
The Tea Party is a corporate finance scheme to channel the populist frustration of the Republican base, because they share the miseries of the rest of the 99%, but this was a very well-orchestrated and highly funded attempt by Republican operatives to channel that frustration. They did in many ways a good job of it. They created a little bit of a Frankenstein's monster, and that the Tea Party is so fanatical on certain issues that it's now beginning to consume the Republican leaders who wanted to create it in the first place. So they've got a little problem on their hands
yes,
with that.
They do.
But the Tea Party is so extreme that its views, according to the polls, are not endorsed by more than maybe 20% of the population in that range somewhere. Occupy, on the other hand, was the target of a very coordinated, as it now turns out, attempt to suppress the move altogether. First of all, it was ridiculed in the media and attacked in the media. Secondly, and I poo-pooed this, by the way, I was skeptical when people started saying the national security apparatus has been turned against Occupy. I thought that sounded to me like conspiracy theory, but the Center for Media and Democracy has done a terrific report. They filed a Freedom of Information Act on this. I encourage people to look it up, studying just this Arizona, what was done using what's called the Fusion Center of the Homeland Security Department in Arizona, working at times in collaboration with the Security Department of J.P. Morgan Chase, for example, to spy on Occupy, which is astonishing that the National Security Department would target a nonviolent movement and ignore, as far as we know, the Tea Party, where they were bringing guns to rallies. So if you were going to worry about anybody, I would have thought you would have been worried about the guys with the guns talking about violent revolution, which some of their speakers do. Yes. But instead, so Occupy was very strongly targeted. But again, let's remember that in order to win national office, Democrats tend to believe they need corporate money, and right. There are many, many Democrats, including the President of the United States, who really reflect a Wall Street-friendly view of the world, and this is the same view of the world that led to the 2008 crisis, but it was Democrats working with Republicans. It was Larry Summers, who President Obama wanted to run the Federal Reserve. It was Larry Summers. It was the Bill Clinton administration and their team of economic folks working in conjunction with conservative Republicans like Phil Graham and so on, who deregulated Wall Street to begin with. So Cory Booker in New Jersey, Senate candidate, is the Democratic candidate of Wall Street. So you have the split in the Democratic Party, but the dominant force right now are the Wall Street Democrats. So they don't really, they like the rhetoric of the 99%. They like the rhetoric of Occupy. They'd love to do what the Tea Party, what the Republicans did with the Tea Party, but they do not want to actually walk. They're happy to talk the talk. They don't want to walk the walk on Wall Street reform because these are their backers and campaign funders. And, you know, no candidate in history has received more money up to that point than Barack Obama in 2008 from Wall Street. So, you know, they want to maintain the status quo to the extent possible. Then you have the insurgent Democrats, as they like to call them. You have Elizabeth Warren, yes. Jeff Merkley, Sherrod Brown on the Senate Banking Committee, who are able to really essentially block the Summers nomination. Mm-hmm. You have, well, Bernie Sanders is an independent and socialist, yeah. But you have Bernie Sanders in the House. You have many of the House progressives really speaking up against Wall Street, but they walk carefully. They know that Wall Street could target their districts and throw millions of dollars into causing them to fail for re-election. So that's why the Democrats haven't fully embraced the Occupy platform, although I strongly believe, based on the polls, that not only could they increase their turnout if they did, but they'd win a lot of independent Republican votes, too, because the polls show that independents and Republicans are also frustrated with economic injustice.
Absolutely. I agree with you, Richard, that to let this incredible, unique, powerful energy just slip away all because they need the money is just, I think it's somewhat dumb politics, but this is yet another reason why campaign finance reform is at the bottom of so many issues. If you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, our guest is R.J. Richard Esko, who's writes a lot with Campaign for America's Future and just has really good analysis of so many political issues. And we talk about the NSA, and a lot of us have been curious why the National Security Agency is there and why it's so powerful and why they're coming down so hard on the whistleblowers who merely tell the truth about it. And, you know, they hide behind, fighting against terrorist attacks, but there's nothing of that. There's virtually nothing of that going on. They're not doing that. They're there for other reasons. And you mentioned that, and it was very, very interesting when you mentioned that. And as of course, if we remember, 2 years ago, the police came down very, very heavily on the Occupy protesters. Some real brutality there across the country. People really got hurt. And today, even in small towns in America, we see a very disturbing militarization of local police. They're getting new tanks or, euphemistically called armored personnel carriers, they're being added to even small police departments. And the police cite the Occupy movement as a reason for such purchases. Could you comment on that, please?
Well, you know, there's that saying, you're absolutely right, and there's that saying, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yeah.
And what we have is increasingly a national security state, and there's big, big, big money involved in it. This is, you know, obviously I write from an economics point of view. I tend to think that, you know, economics influences more political and social behavior than we often realize or think about. But, I mean, that company is making an enormous amount of money by expanding the federal national security state and by building up this infrastructure and local police forces. It's extremely frightening and enormous overkill. You know, I mean, what we really have, whether it's armored personnel carriers or the sale of drones or some of the anti-personnel weapons that are being used, like focused sound beams in order to disperse demonstrations and that kind of thing.
Whoa.
What we're really seeing are very militarized crowd control weaponry. And some of this, for example, the sound beams, including beams, by the way, that make the skin feel unbearably hot. So you have to run so that people in a demonstration or walking on the street run and scream and try to hide, and you can disperse a demonstration that way, which is, in effect, a remote control weapon of torture. A lot of these weapons are being tested in Iraq and other battle zones. What we're really seeing is an infusion, you know, and again, this starts to sound like conspiracy theory, but it's all very well documented.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, of crowd control technology in the domestic American states. So the problem with this, among other things, is once you build it, then once you have it,
yeah,
you want to use it.
Right.
So we have to be very careful about creating the capability that then police forces around the country are going to be extremely tempted to use needlessly on a group like Occupy. And interestingly enough, although I'm rough on libertarians in my writing, this is one area of potential alliance between left and right, is to say, you know, this country should be very, very protective of its civil liberties and very significantly less eager to throw away our rights for a false sense of security or for the profits of a few corporations.
And it does seem that there's some tremendous potential there for a new alliance and a new political power with people who care about that. I mean, the money behind the Tea Party is one thing, but a lot of the people who are attracted to the Tea Party, they've seen that as, you know, as a way, as a channel, as an instrument for speaking about their frustration at the government isn't working for us, the regular people. It's working for the top. And I think there's some potential alliances there. One of the problems, I think, has been that certainly the power structure, the people behind the NSA and the security state, they want people to feel powerless. They want people to believe we are powerless. And, you know, we're consumers, okay, but not citizens, no. That it seemed to me that perhaps more than any other Western democracy, Americans really believe we are powerless. I wonder, do you think Occupy changed that to some effect? And, you know, it seems to me that what happened to Larry Summers, what's happened to, you know, the bombing of Syria, the people were not powerless. Do you think that Occupy helped people realize, you know what, we can make some change? Or then again, what change? You know, there hasn't been as dramatic change as the organizers of Occupy would like. But what do you think about that? Is there a change in Americans' belief that we're powerless that can be attributed to the Occupy movement?
Well, I think that yes. I think yes is the short answer. And again,
okay,
you know, I tend to think of Occupy as a reflection of deeper forces rather than the source of those deeper forces. But I think what Occupy showed people is that you can make even the most powerful people listen, whether it's the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase or the President of the United States or members of the United States Senate. I think that was the lesson, and I think that does resonate. I think that I also think that our leaders, including, you know, I have an economist friend who meets regularly with bank CEOs who says these guys are genuinely frightened about what the public thinks about them and might do. They're more sensitive to that than people realize. I think our political leaders tend to get insensitive to that, but then they get reminders like the blowback on Larry Summers, and I think this does tie into the potential for left-right alliances of certain kinds. Remember, populism as a movement has always been, you know, something that can appear on the left or the right.
Yes.
And I think it's our responsibility to channel that energy properly and in the right directions. You know, I gave a speech at a demonstration in front of the Treasury Department about, 2010 maybe, and a reporter from one of the right-wing news sites, state or town hall, I think, came up to me afterwards and said, you know, nothing that you said, and it was a pretty fiery speech, she said, nothing that you said could not have been said at the Tea Party rally. And my answer was, invite me. I'll go.
Yeah.
I'll talk to those guys. They may not be happy with my views on racial equality or gun control or whatever, but economically, they may find that this message is very attractive and that, you know, instead of using that frustration as the Tea Party and its corporate sponsors do to push for deregulation and tax breaks that make the rich rich, say, no, we feel the pain you feel, but let's talk sensibly about how to fix that. And
right.
I think that's what we have to do, whether it's on civil liberties, whether it's on economic justice. I mean, look, we can't tailor our own views so that they'll always be palatable to the right, but I think the Larry Summers shoot down was, in a sense, a merger of left and right.
Yep.
I think, you know, Bernie Sanders and Ron Paul
worked
together to audit the Federal Reserve. I think that was neat. And I think that Senator Rand Paul's filibuster against drone killings was horrific. So I think there will be times when we can work together. And let's think in terms of, and I think that's another thing that Occupy brought to the table. Let's not think in terms of Democrat, Republican, liberal, and conservative. Let's think of the people and representing them and getting them taken care of and fairly treated in the halls of power. I think that that's a better framing, and I think that's a good way to go forward.
So I wonder the movement, the physical manifestation of the movement has pretty much vanished. But it does seem that the message, the 99 versus 1, is now embedded into the American consciousness. I wonder if there's reason for optimism. Do you see sentiment and principles of the Occupy movement having still momentum, that people are perhaps working in different ways? Is there reason for optimism that the Occupy not only that the message got out, that the people understood it, but that it is making a difference and has a real potential for making things actually better?
Well, I think there is. I think there's no question that the 99% framing is now permanently embedded in the public's consciousness, which is terrific. I think it's given a lot of exposure in policy circles, in certain circles anyway, to the work of economists like Richard Wolff, whose life's work, or Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez, the people who have devoted their life as economists to studying wealth inequality and its effect on the economy. So I think that, I think that it has changed the dialogue, and I think that's terrific. I think that the movement, while it's not publicly visible, has created informal and sometimes more formal network people who want to continue to work together for change. And I think that, look, you know, history is unwritten, but I think it's led almost directly to the election of, for example, of Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think she's going to be a very powerful voice in the years to come. I think, you know, the other senators who think as she does, like Jeff Merkley and so on, and Bernie Sanders, will continue to be extremely visible. But I think that people shouldn't rely on politicians. I think that was the other message of Occupy. So I think that there are good, potentially very good things coming. And I think that one lasting effect of Occupy is that we don't as I think people understand it now on some deep level, maybe one they're not aware of, but I think it's embedded somewhere in people's consciousness now that we can act, we can organize, we can be heard.
Right.
And what form that takes next, I'm not entirely sure. But listen, the Democrats had to change their entire political platform to respond to Occupy. Had they not done that, I think Obama would have lost, and they might have lost the Senate. I think they realized they were losing their base, so they pivoted left. They started talking, the president started talking about jobs, started talking about the middle class, started talking about equality. Before that, if you remember, all he'd been talking about was controlling the deficit, a very conservative economic message. So I think that, and compromising and governing above left and right, quote unquote, with the Republicans. So I think that saved his presidency because his poll plunging as he did that.
Right.
They rose again. So did the Democrats as a party when they pivoted to the left. To a certain extent, that was insincere, but to a certain extent, they followed through on it. So I think Occupy changed the political landscape. I think it will continue to appear in that way. I think that one of the reasons the president backed off on Summers, besides the fact that nomination couldn't get through, is he doesn't want to alienate his base completely. They backed down on, they're trying to strike a different stance prosecuting Wall Street, although they're really not doing much yet. But they're feeling the heat. So I think that the reverberations of Occupy continue and could take new and surprising and interesting form going forward.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. R.J. Esko, it's great to talk to you. If people want to follow your work, where can they go on the Internet?
Well, they can go to Our Future, O-U-R, ourfuture.org. They can go to the Huffington Post. They can Google Richard Eskow, E-S-K-O-W, or just, I guess, listen to the police band and see who's being tracked by the NSA. So.
All right. Well, thank you again so much for being with us. Thanks for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show, Richard Eskow.
Thanks for having me.
All the tears of America.